Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
The conductus is a song. The particular designation conductus derives from the fact that it was first used to accompany liturgical processions.
The preservation and performance of medieval European music, this week on Soundings. My guest is Janet Knapp of Vassar College. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Janet Knapp is at work on a project entitled The Polyphonic Conductus, a study of one of the principal categories of music that occupied composers of the Parisian school of Notre Dame in the latter part of the 12th century and the early decades of the 13th. Janet Knapp, welcome to Soundings. Tell me about the polyphonic conductus.
The polyphonic conductus is a two, three, very rarely four-voiced setting of a Latin poetic text.
How is it that you locate it in the 12th century instead of the 15th? Why is it that you connect it to the what you call the Parisian school instead of another, what, area of Europe?
We have to use a lot of extra musical evidence to answer questions like this. Art historians and music historians have been able to identify the principal source of the polyphonic conductus as a French manuscript, a Parisian manuscript. We have external evidence from theoretical writers telling us about certain compositions that were created for given feasts of the church year during the tenure of a given bishop. By that, we are able to locate the time around 1198-1199 of two or three liturgical compositions related to the conductus.
Mm-hmm. In the description of your project here at the Humanities Center, Janet Knapp, you use the term cultural hegemony, and you connect that again with Paris. Are there special or peculiar reasons for that connection?
Well, of course, the University of Paris is one of the leading universities of the medieval period. People came there from all over Europe. They used to speak about the nations at the University of Paris, meaning those who came from Germany, those who came from the Low Countries, those who came from Italy, and so on. It was a leading intellectual center of the time. In the Parisian repertory, the range of the conductus is somewhat expanded. That is to say, we still have pieces which are processional pieces, but other pieces which may have served other functions. As an example of the former, we might hear Redit Aetas Aurea, a song in honor of the coronation of Richard the Lionhearted in 1189.
Redit Aetas Aurea, mundus renovatur, dives nunc deprimitur, pauper exaltatur, omnis suo principi, plebs congratulatur, nec est locus sceleri, scelus datur funeri, scandala fuga. Ah, 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 ah.
We have heard a two-voiced conductus. The first voice, the original voice, has the characteristics of song, that is to say, a limited range and lots of melodic repetition. A second voice is added to it to enrich it, ornament it. The setting is very straightforward, largely one note to a syllable. But at the end, the composer, who is anonymous, has dressed it up by adding a tale, as the theorists call it, a wordless passage, a melisma.
How do we know, Janet Knapp, that this medieval music, here we're going back to the late 12th and the early 13th century in France, how do we know that this stuff sounds to us the way it sounded to medieval audiences?
Of course, we can't know for sure that it sounds the way it did to them, but there are things we can know. There are theoretical writers, so-called. Actually, they're very practical observers of the musical scene, and they describe the way in which this, to us, ambiguous notation should be read.
These are people who were present at the performances.
Yes, or they knew the music as it had been recorded on parchment. And,
I see.
They were certainly in the line of hearing music as well as looking at it on the page. And they tell us how to read the music, and the ornamental passage, which you heard at the end of Redit Aetas Aurea, is the less ambiguous. And because it's written in groups of notes, ligatures they're called, and given a certain series or sequence of ligatures, we can deduce a certain rhythmic pattern. This is because there are no syllables to break up the patterns of groups or ligatures, which are described by the theorists. They explain to us the way in which we are to read them. When you put in a lot of syllables, or if you're setting a lot of syllables, those ligatures are broken up, leaving undifferentiated note forms.
I see.
And those are the more problematical. Fortunately, we have a few examples in the conductus repertory of melismatic passages to which a text has been added. This is not the usual sequence, it's the other way around. But in these half dozen examples, we have melismatic versions as well as syllabic versions. The next piece that we're going to hear is Crucifigat Omnes, a crusading piece, an exhortation to somebody, possibly Frederick II, to
come home and get off the dime. Wasn't that it, basically, what you told me?
Something like that, yes. And the melisma exists attached to a two-voice composition, and somebody, again, we don't know who, we don't know who the poet is, we don't know who the composer is, but somebody added a text to this melisma. On the basis of the melismatic version, we can form fairly firm conclusions about the way the syllabic version sounded.
Okay, let's listen.
Crucifigat omnes, Domini crux altera, nova Christi vulnera, ab salutifera, peditu sepulcrum, gense vetit extera, violente plena gente, sola sedet civitas, ani fetus rapidetus, glora dotes perditas, sponsa Sion immolatur, Ananias incurvatur, cornu David flagellatur mundus, ab injustis abdicatur, perquem iuste judicatur mundus.
Janet Knapp, we have just heard the Crucifigat Omnes. How does that differ from the preceding example? We're talking here about ambiguities of notation and interpretation.
It differs in two ways. The most prominent difference, perhaps, is in the declamatory rhythm.
What does that mean?
The syllables of Redit Aetas Aurea, the first piece, are declaimed in longish values, values of equal length. And those of Crucifigat Omnes are declaimed in long and short values, alternating long and short values. Mm-hmm. These two patterns relate to what the theorists call rhythmic modes. The first one is the fifth rhythmic mode. Crucifigat Omnes is the first rhythmic mode. A second difference in the pieces is, of course, that Redit Aetas Aurea concludes with a melisma, Crucifigat does not.
What about the mixture of the sacred and the secular? How were these renditions, these processionals, performed? In front of whom? Who listened to them?
This is a very difficult question to which we do not have a clear answer. A large proportion of the polyphonic conductus from the Notre Dame repertory are sacred pieces. Whether they found a place in the liturgy, as they had at an earlier time, whether they were sung at clerical gatherings of some sort, we can't be certain. They were sung for a sophisticated audience. They're sophisticated in terms of their poetic structure and their musical structure.
Hmm.
Here, for instance, is Circa Mundi Vesperam, a text which is appropriate to Passiontide. Whether it occurred in the liturgy or in a sophisticated clerical gathering, we can't say for sure. The scholar will sing the original voice, the first voice, for you so that you can hear the strophic repetition in the music. They will then follow it with the two-voice version, which then concludes again with an ornamental melisma. Like Crucifigat Omnes, this piece is in the first rhythmic mode.
Circa mundi vesperam, salvan sibi dexteram, legis literam, spiritus complanat, vulneratum sanat, vir Samaritanus, canis fulgens trabea, visus in edumea, sed avinea, custos repelitur, ege persequitur medicum insanus.
Now here is the two-voiced setting.
Circa mundi vesperam, salvan sibi dexteram, legis literam, spiritus complanat, vulneratum sanat, vir Samaritanus. Canis fulgens trabea, visus in idumea, sed avinea. Custos repelitur, ecce persequitur, medicum insanus.
Janet Knapp, we are listening to examples of the polyphonic conductus. You said at the outset of our conversation that we would hear several voices. So far, to my untrained ear, I detect only two. Tell me about this.
You're quite right. The majority of pieces are for two voices, but there's a substantial number for three voices.
Uh-huh.
We're going to listen to one of those three-voice pieces now. In terms of its subject matter, it's a mystery. People have attempted to translate this clearly secular text, something to do with absence making the heart grow fonder, something to do with somebody who wants to break up a relationship.
It's a love song. Is that possible?
I think you may say that.
Uh-huh.
This is set for three voices in a way that was particularly popular in England. Indeed, this piece might have originated in England rather than in France. There are two reasons for saying this. One is the structure, which is that of the rondellas, which is like a round, except that instead of starting one at a time, as we do when we sing Frère Jacques, for example, mm-hmm. Everybody begins at the same time but keeps trading off the same material.
What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Procuron's Odium, and the English aspect of it is further testified to by the use of thirds. There's a kind of richness in the sound. Somebody who heard this piece sung by the Scola a few weeks ago referred to it as a barbershop type.
Let's listen. Janet Knapp, what we've just heard here is the Procurons, an example of late 12th, 13th century medieval music. We've just heard a group of young women recreate this music. The other examples done by a group of young men. Does that make any difference as you restore, reconstitute this music?
I think that it's fair for men or women to sing these pieces. Undoubtedly, more of them were sung by men. However, recall that in the choirs, the liturgical groups, there were boys. Boys could have sung these. And I think that in conventual settings, women might also have sung them. So I don't think that they are the property of men.
I see. Does it, how, for example, do questions about the rhetoric and the liturgical, apart from the musical dimension, the liturgical dimension, the doctrinal element in these examples that we're listening to, how does that interest you as a historian of medieval music?
It interests me a great deal. A great deal of my work on the conductus has been on the content and the symbolism of the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
The example we're about to hear is one of the most famous conductus to have come down to us, and it is a piece for the Feast of the Circumcision. The great majority of the sacred pieces have to do with the Incarnation. Not Christmas, really, but with the doctrine of the Incarnation with its corollary, the Atonement. Uh-huh. So many pieces start out looking as if they might be Christmas pieces, but referring at the end to the Passion and Death of Christ.
This is one of the great essential theological questions.
It's the central dogma.
Let me stop you momentarily, Janet Knapp. You haven't yet mentioned anything about a specific composer. Do we know anything about the author of this example we're about to hear?
Yes, we do. It's a rare example. An English theorist of the from the late 13th century names a composer, Perrotin the Great, or the Master Perrotin, whose music, he says, is still in use in the Church of Notre Dame. He names several liturgical pieces by Perrotin, and he names three or four conductus. Salvatoris Hodie is a three-voiced setting with elaborate melismatic ornamentation. We will hear only the opening strophe of the piece.
Let's listen.
Salvatoris Hodie, sanguis pregusta. Hey.
Janet Knapp, before our taping session for Soundings, you talked about the interplay here in this, about the interplay between poetry and music. Tell me about that. How did the composers, what little we know about them, or the audiences think of that interplay?
I think they saw the poetry and the music as equals. The poetry is far too sophisticated in most cases to be ignored by the audience. On the other hand, it is ornamented, enriched by the music, and the preoccupation certainly of the composers is with the music, the musical setting. It would be a mistake, I believe, to try to see the music as any kind of interpretation of the text. Thus, for example, the processional piece for the coronation and the love song sung by the young women are both declaimed in the same basic rhythm. At the same time, on the other hand, the crusading piece and the passiontide piece are declaimed in a much faster rhythm. This is not to suggest that there is really any difference in poetic content.
How widely did these musical examples that we've been listening to, Janet Knapp, how widely did they circulate themselves? Were they known to what we would call the popular culture, the medieval equivalent of our popular culture, mass audiences?
I would think not. They do, many of the pieces occur in several different manuscripts, but nearly all of the manuscripts are of Parisian origin. There is one that undoubtedly comes from Spain. There are a couple from Germany. So the pieces did migrate. I would think of them always, however, as having been performed for a select audience. Incidentally, I should also have mentioned the British connection. One of our principal sources for the Polyphonic Conductus is a manuscript which at one time belonged to the Monastery of St. Andrews in Scotland and which we believe originated in Britain. Englishmen went to Paris to study. The aforenamed theorist, for example, who gave us the name of Paratan. The English style is prevalent in, or appears in some of the French sources. The Procurans Odium that we heard later is an example. There is a strong connection between Paris and Britain. We haven't worked out yet all the details of that.
Is it fun to track this down, Janet? Do you,
well,
how do you do
yes,
that?
It is, and people are working on it all the time. We have many differences of opinion expressed still about the origins of that British manuscript, but in time we'll find the answer.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Janet Knapp. I'll look at you wide-eyed. Why is this stuff important? Obviously, it's important to you as a music historian, you and your colleagues in music history. Does it... Why are you passionate about it when we talk about the history of music in the 20th century and look backward?
Well, I'm passionate about the repertory as a whole. That is the conductus and the liturgical music, the organum that's written at the same time, because it marks the beginning of the first enduring tradition of polyphonic composition.
This is something that's lasted a long time.
It's lasted a long time. And while there had been polyphonic composition prior to this time, it simply died out. Winchester had a great repertory for a short time, but then it vanished. The same is true of Aquitaine.
Why is this stuff important now? Is it important in our sense of musical history here at the end of the 20th century?
I believe it is. I will say that the repertory contains a large amount of spectacularly well-written music. And well-written music from any period, it seems to me, deserves our attention.
So we're not necessarily more sophisticated musically now by comparison with our these medieval authors and audiences, 700-800 years ago?
I think it's fair to say that. We may sometimes be more complex. But not necessarily more sophisticated.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Janet Knapp of Vassar College. During a fellowship year at the center, Janet Knapp is at work on a project entitled The Polyphonic Conductus. The renditions of European medieval music on this edition of Soundings were provided by students from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and from Vassar College. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 451. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove and Helen Vendler, poetry critic for The New Yorker magazine. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Late May 1883 marked the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge. Its cost was $16 million. The establishment of Argentine political independence from Spain occurred in late May 1810. During the third week in May 1881, nearly 200 people lost their lives on the Thames River near London, Ontario, when the Canadian ship Victoria heeled over. The third week in May marks birthdays for the American astronaut Sally Ride, the English physician and writer Arthur Conan Doyle, and the American dancer Isadora Duncan. Sally Ride was born in 1951, Arthur Conan Doyle in 1859, and Isadora Duncan in 1878. Finally, two artists, one German, one American, both with an interest in the first president of the United States, share birthdays in late May. Emmanuel Luzzi was born in 1816, more than a decade after Washington's death. James Peel was born in 1749, nearly 20 years after Washington's birth. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Medieval music, its preservation and performance, this week on Soundings. Listen for Janet Knapp of Vassar College. Janet Knapp is working on a study of the polyphonic conductus, one of the principal categories of music in the Parisian School of Notre Dame that flourished during the latter part of the 12th century and the early decades of the 13th. The Polyphonic Conductus, a discussion featuring Janet Knapp of Vassar College, together with musical examples, this week on Soundings.